What a lovely thing it is for me to be here with you this morning again. So, I'm Pastor Chris, which is weird. I know not a lot of UU clergy use the term pastor, but I'll explain that. That's a story for another day. You don't have to call me Pastor Chris. In fact, you should just probably call me Chris. And all I ask is that you remember it's Chris with a K. And even that, I'll pass on. I was born and raised in Waco, Texas, as you heard. After Waco, I lived in Austin for 8 years, then Germany for 5 years, and then for our last year in the military in Junction City, Kansas, which I also have some good stories about. Back in Waco, with our two sons in tow, and I jumped into church life, there's a whole long story about how I got from there to here, and that's, again, a story for another day. But here I am. And I can just, I want to say quickly before I get started, I feel a sort of excitement about being here with you. This is only the second church that I've ever worked in. At first, I was mostly just trepidatious, but as soon as I met you all and I came and visited and I had such a warm welcome, it all began to really come into this sense of fizzing and bubbling and like, oh my goodness, a wonderful community that I get to be part of for whatever time that we have to share. And so I just want to say that I've seen such a strong sense of investment, which some of us clergy type might even call devotion. And so I think that this is a wonderful community, and I'm honored to be invited into it. So a few more things to know about me beyond what you already heard. If you're an Enneagram person, I am an Enneagram 7, hardcore, with a strong 8 wing. If you're a Myers-Briggs person, the most important thing to know about me is that on the descriptions next to extrovert, there is a photo of me. So, you already heard that I'm a sci-fi geek. I love to read. My first degree was in music, and I love to sing. And my family is all here except for my dogs, Wolfgang and Rico, and my cat, Zed, because they prefer to sleep in on Sundays. So that's a good start. We'll get to know each other further through conversation. And now I'm going to jump right into our reflection for today. I want to tell you about this gift that I recently received that I did not expect at all. I was driving down a road, one of those roads that's sort of hovering between being a country road and being a suburban road. You know what I'm talking about. There's a field on one side and a housing development on the other, you know. So I'm just driving. It was in East Texas, and all of a sudden, out of a big, tall pine tree just off the road, this hawk just shot out right in front of my car and just flew, like, ahead of me and above me, just effortlessly for, like, blocks and blocks. It just kept going, and I was just driving like this and trying not to hit people and staring at the hawk. There weren't any other cars on the road, and it just felt like a gift someone had given me out of nowhere. The hawk stayed with me for a long time, and when it left, I gave this one of those sighs, you know, just grace, felt like grace. And in the song today that we sang, our reflection hymn, the chorus says, "We are blessed with love and amazing grace when our heart is in a holy place." And it's a beautiful song. I love it. And the words sound really good, although there is questionable grammar because when our hearts are in, anyway. There's also even beyond the grammar issues. Yes, I'm a nerd. Did I mention it? There's a theological problem with this song that is big enough that a lot of UU ministers, and who knows who else, have stopped choosing it altogether. And their argument is that grace, the grace that's cited in that song, is presented all wrong. And as much as I love the song, I think they could be right. Because the song implies that when our heart is in a holy place, only then are we blessed with love and amazing grace. And the thing about grace, the literal, exact, theologically sound, kid-tested, and mom-approved understanding of grace is that it's exactly the opposite of that. It is unexpected and undeserved. Grace is the gift that comes without expectation or condition. If grace depended on our hearts being in holy places, it wouldn't be grace. It would be a transaction. You give me goodness, I'll give you grace. In theology, grace is most simply defined as God's favor freely given. Now, if you're like me, a graceless, combat-boot-wearing rabble-rouser, the idea of meekly accepting a handout from God, which in all my baggage is definitely an old white dude with a long beard and some robes in charge of a cosmic church full of smug marrieds and judgy church ladies. Well, I don't even want a handout from you. That would be somewhere between distasteful and infuriating. But just like it's supposed to, seminary turned my life upside down, and one of the exciting things that happened is that I got a new translation superpower. So if the idea of God's favor freely given makes you somewhat queasy, you can always try love's favor freely given. And that sounds like poetry to me. It lets me release some of my defensiveness and be curious again. And oh wait, that feels almost like grace. That inward turn from certainty of pain to the possibility of renewal. Ooh, love's favor freely given. Going back to Paul Tillich, who we already heard from, grace strikes us when we are in great pain and restlessness. It strikes us when we walk through the dark valley of a meaningless and empty life. Grace strikes us when we feel that our separation is deeper than usual because we have violated another life, a life which we loved or from whom we were estranged. It strikes us when our disgust for our own self-being, our indifference, our weakness, our hostility, and our lack of direction and composure have become entirely intolerable to us. It strikes us when year after year the longed-for perfection of life does not arise. When the old compulsions reign within us as they have for decades, when despair destroys all joy and courage. Again, note Tillich's invocation of separation and violation. Those are also two key elements in defining evil along with sin. He goes on, sometimes, just sometimes, at that moment, a wave of light breaks into our darkness, and it is as though a voice was saying, you are accepted. You are accepted, accepted by that which is greater than you and the name of which you do not know. Don't ask for the name now. Perhaps you will find it later. Do not try to do anything now. Perhaps later you will do much. Do not seek for anything. Do not perform anything. Do not intend anything. Simply accept the fact that you are accepted. If that happens to us, we experience grace. Back to my words. I have never once felt that my moments of grace were truly deserved. Happiness? Yes, I think we all deserve happiness or an honest chance at it. And I think it's something we can work for, keeping in mind, of course, that vital footnote that most of us here live privileged lives, that the grace of receiving $100 a week for life is just luck in many ways. And we do have the time and the energy to intentionally seek out and work for happiness. So that's a footnote to all that. But grace isn't the same as happiness. Back to Tillich one last time. And I love this. This is pretty much the pith of Tillich for me on this topic. After such an experience of grace, we may not be better than before. And we may not believe more than before, but everything is transformed. In that moment, grace conquers sin, and reconciliation bridges the gulf of estrangement. And nothing is demanded of this experience. No religious or moral or intellectual presupposition. Nothing but acceptance. In the light of this grace, we perceive the power of grace in our relation to others and to ourselves. We experience the grace of being able to look frankly into the eye of another, the miraculous grace of reunion of life with life. The miraculous grace of union with life, with life, of life with life. Grace is the indrawn breath and the long, slow exhale. It's the unexpected kindness of others and an expression of our hope in the world, in other people, in ourselves. But here's the thing, the hard thing, the true hard thing about grace is that it doesn't come when we expect it or when we think we need it. And when it does show up, for most of us, it does go away as well. It doesn't stay unless we have reached the status of enlightenment. Like happiness, sadness, and life itself, grace is fleeting. If it's love's favor freely given, we have to remember that favors aren't guaranteed. Love, perhaps, is always willing to be gifted and granted and graced. But human love only works through human hands. Our hands, our hearts, our voices and our actions. The grace Tillich speaks about, the grace that conquers our selfishness, the grace that bridges the gulf of estrangement, that requires human action and human attention. Even the steadfast grace of the earth can only act upon us when we are ready to see, feel, and receive it. Receiving grace happens best when we're paying attention. Another real hard truth, not with grace, but just with me and life, is that I struggle with hopelessness right now. Sometimes all this talk of grace just feels like whistling past the graveyard, a temporary comfort in the face of an eternal mortality and a world in turmoil and trouble and distress. In this time of deceit and danger, it's hard for me to have hope or to hold it. But hope is important to me and to all of us. It may be the most important thing to all of us, and I kind of think that perhaps Unitarian Universalists are the most hopeful of all denominations, because why else would we all be here together, willing to throw in our lots with each other? We're smart people. Many of us have given up completely on the idea of supernaturalism in religion, and all of us have had to come to terms with our God or goddess or gods or no God by now. Maybe you're here trying to do that. And if so, welcome. Me too. My own agnosticism isn't a lack of commitment to either path, the secular or the religious, but a conscious choice to live in the tension between the two. I dwell every day in the liminal space of not knowing, and I bet many of you do too. And all of us, the certain and the uncertain, the believers and the questioners and the pragmatists and the dreamers, we all share something in common, and that is hope. As a kind and humane songwriter I know puts it, hope that perhaps all is not lost. Hope that we can change the world. Hope that we can save it just a little bit, a little at a time, or maybe in great sweeping social movements of change, or better yet, both. Why not? This kind of hope is frankly irrational. Humans are bound for extinction like every other species, our own and others, and in the face of this existential threat, I mean, it may not be until Betelgeuse explodes, and that's going to be in 300,000 years, so don't worry, but in the face of this existential threat, and of course the very much more real existential threat of climate change, in the face of rising nationalism and white supremacy, in the face of overpopulation and the possibilities of nuclear war and salted earth and rising temperatures, what keeps us hopeful? I don't know, and like I say, I struggle with this. Despair has its own allure. No more fighting, no more struggle. I just want to wrap myself in my safe, cozy privilege and let it all go. All the passion, all the work, all the fighting. Sometimes I want to throw my combat boots to the back of the closet and put on my house shoes and just stop caring so much. Have you felt that? Yeah, it's hard times. A friend of mine who wrestles with extreme anxiety told me a story. At one point in her life, her anxiety was so overwhelming that she was only able to leave her home for a few specific things. Basically, she went to work, she came home, and she went to therapy appointments. She couldn't go to the grocery store. She couldn't go to the movies. She couldn't go out to breakfast or lunch or dinner with her friends. She went to no special fun things. She's a wonderful singer. She didn't sing. She was lucky that she had family who could care for her. They bought the groceries and paid the bills, comforted and protected her as best as they could. And her therapist asked her this question one day. What do you get out of being so afraid all the time? She, of course, instantly went on the defensive It's terrible, she said. I don't get anything out of it. It gets everything out of me. But then over the next days and hours and days and weeks and months, she couldn't stop thinking about it, and she began to catalog those ways that she was taken care of. The groceries were bought and the bills were paid. Her partner and her best friend took turns holding her hand and sitting with her through the worst of the anxiety and the panic. And there it was, finally, the reminder of just how much she was loved, the gift of gratitude and the recognition of grace. It came through her counselor's willingness to be brave and say something the client, the patient, would probably not want to hear. And it came also through my friend's willingness to hold that thought and to work through her angry defensiveness and see the question for the offer of grace that it was. My friend experienced the grace of being able to look frankly into the eyes of another. And so her story has offered me many times a glimpse of hope when I'm in the midst of my own despair. I can look around and say, where is the grace? What am I grateful for? How are all these people helping me? And that is grace too. The stories we tell each other, the moments of easy breath they can give us. I get trapped in my own head sometimes, and maybe I do succumb to that desire to check out sometimes. But grace always comes, so far. Sometimes it comes through human means, the grace that we show to one another and to the world, even when we know that we don't deserve it. The world always deserves it. And really, secret, we all do. And that's grace too. So this is where I want to come back really quickly to our pretty troublesome song, When Our Heart is in a Holy Place. I found a new way to think about the words. Perhaps when our heart is in a holy place, it's not so much that we're more likely to receive grace, but that we are more likely to give grace. When our wells are full, when we have cataloged our gratitudes, when we have been given hope and stories and more hope and lots of love by all the people and the communities we're in, then our hearts are more able to give a holy grace. And with that in mind, I've begun to rehabilitate this song for myself, and I'm trying to spread the good word of its restoration. And that's why I wanted to sing it today, because it is beautiful, and because I do think it should be sung. I just think we should tune our ears a little differently for it. Wrapping up, it seems to me that grace is stumbled upon most often, for myself, in the wild and beautiful and uncaring paths of nature. The hawk sweeping down the road before me, the way that my snapdragons have persisted throughout all this cold. They're still blooming despite cold snaps and freezes. They are bright pink and purple among all the tattered leaves and faded green of my lawn and my front garden. And that's grace, too, because when I see it, it reminds me of hope. Oh, look how crazy and dumb this plant is. Grace. It gives me hope. It's persisting, like we want to do. It's not really a question of when grace can strike me. It's a question of paying attention to it when it's all around me. I don't know where grace is born. Maybe it is a gift from a loving God. Maybe it's a matter of blind luck and occasional attention. It doesn't ask anything of us, not right away. In the moment of grace, Tillich says, remember that we are bid to be still and accept that we are known, named, and accepted. Connected. You are accepted and connected to that which is greater than you, he writes, and the name of which you do not know. Do not try to do anything now. Perhaps later you will do much. Do not seek for anything. Do not perform anything. Do not intend anything. Simply accept the fact that you are accepted. Grace is as much the chance to rest as it is anything else. Like I said, the indrawn breath, the long exhale. And after that, after grace comes, we might perhaps begin to hope again, even when it's irrational, especially when it's irrational, like my snapdragons. Hope allows us to go on. Not quickly, necessarily. Going on can mean anything from roaring back into the battle for social justice to slowly learning to emerge from our depressed, anxious, exhausted cocoons, blinking in the light of day. As Tillich said, after such an experience, we may not be better than before, and we may not believe more than before, but everything is transformed. I'd like to close with that Wendell Berry poem again, The Peace of Wild Things. You may have heard it before, perhaps not. If you forget every word that I have said here today, just remember this poem about grace, about hope, about transformation. It's a sermon in much fewer words, many fewer words. As I read it, I hold Paul Tillich's words close as well. Grace is the reunion of life with life, the reconciliation of the self and with the world. Wendell Berry. When despair grows in me and I wake in the night at the least sound in fear of what my life and my children's lives may be, I go and lie down where the wood drake rests in his beauty on the water and the great heron feeds. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. I come into the presence of still water, and I feel above me the day-blind stars waiting for their light. For a time, I rest in the grace of the world and am free. So be it. Amen.